Hello and welcome to Atlantic Brücke's Transatlantic Call. My name is David Deisner. I'm the Executive Director of Atlantic Brücke. And on behalf of Atlantic Brücke, I would like to welcome all of you to the sixth edition of the Transatlantic Call, a new audio format. In these 30-minute conversations, we would like to give you regular first-hand insights into a variety of transatlantic topics and debates. And the conversation will be held, as always, in English. And you can dial in or hang up at any time. To ensure a fluent conversation without external noise on the line, the audience will be on mute, and we are recording this call today. Some of you have already sent us questions beforehand, and we will try, of course, to consider all of them in the following conversation. Today, our transatlantic call is entitled Democracy Under Threat. How can the West respond to the next generation of AI disinformation? And it's my great honor and pleasure to introduce our very special guest in today's call, Dr. Alina Polyakova. She is the David M. Rubinstein Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program Center at the famous Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Alina is also an adjunct professor of European Studies at the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And in her work, she focuses on Russian foreign policy, European populism, and U.S.-Russia-Europe relations. Previously, she served as Director of Research and Senior Fellow for Europe and Eurasia at the Atlantic Council. Alina, you've already been a guest of Atlantic Brücke. Welcome so much. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
And the moderator of today's call is Tyson Barker. He is Deputy Director and Fellow at the Aspen Institute. Tyson is a foreign and economic professional with in-depth experience working at senior levels in government and the think tank community. He specializes in international affairs, U.S.-Russia relations, and cybersecurity. Tyson Barker's analyses appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, and Politico. And above all, of course, he is a 2014 young leader of Atlantic Brücke. Welcome to the call. And with that, I would like to hand over to you, Tyson. Let's start the conversation.
All right. Thanks so much, David, and thanks for everybody who's on the call, and especially to Alina. I know we're going to have a very rich conversation in the next 30 minutes, so let's just jump right in. You know, when we talk about misinformation, when we talk about hybrid warfare, disinformation, the year 2016 stands out. That was the wake-up call. Of course, we had the election in the United States. We had the Brexit referendum where disinformation campaigns from abroad played a role, and we had a lesser-known but equally consequential influence campaign in the Dutch referendum on Ukraine's association agreement with the European Union. But what I want to ask you, Alina, just to start us off, is what's happened since? We've spent a lot of time in the political arena talking about what happened in 2016, but where are we now and what is the next iteration of this threat?
Great, so much. Thanks so much, Tyson. That was a fantastic summary, I think, of the key moment when all of us in the West woke up to this phenomenon of state-sponsored disinformation, particularly emanating from Russia. Certainly, I do think it's important to keep in mind that this was not new in terms of Russia's global desire to undermine influence politics in other countries, places like Ukraine, Georgia, countries closer to Russia that Russia considers its legitimate sphere of influence have very much been the testing ground for these kinds of operations. So that relates to your actual question as to, you know, what is coming at us in the very near future and where are we now? Because I think to really understand what might be the next step, especially from Russia, but not just from Russia. I mean, I think this toolkit has become so diffused that we're already seeing other state actors using these kinds of techniques, Iran, North Korea, China will eventually enter this space in a significant way, I believe, as well. So if we look at what the Russian intentions, activities have been in places like Ukraine, we can make some assertions about what we might expect as well. So, you know, 2016 was this critical year, and I think since then we're almost 3 years out from the U.S. presidential elections. What we've seen is that one is this disinformation campaigns, especially as they take place on social media, have not stopped. Two, they become increasingly, I think, I wouldn't say sophisticated, but they certainly evolved in the sense that now we see a lot of, you know, content that we can identify as disinformation, quote unquote, especially from the Russian side, jumping across platforms, being amplified not just by Facebook and Twitter, but also Instagram, the Google results, for example, being manipulated in some capacities when it comes to certain search terms. So all of this is still ongoing. We certainly saw, I think, very prominently during the Skripal attempted poisoning that happened in the UK, for which the Russians have been held responsible, that Russian state-sponsored overt media are very much involved in trying to muddy the waters, trying to undermine governmental efforts to investigate the truth in such cases. I think what we're seeing now is also, on this, as the second point here, is that social media companies have responded to a certain extent. In my view, their response has been relatively superficial and minimal, but they have started taking down disinformation networks, deranking, as they say, automated accounts, et cetera. And there have been also governmental efforts that we can talk about. But again, I still think we are quite far behind in really truly addressing this threat.
We're right at the beginning of this threat. That's a great place to start. So let me start with the point you talked about on Ukraine. So obviously, you said it yourself, Ukraine has been in many ways, in Georgia as well, the laboratories of a lot of these kind of tools and techniques, at least for Russia. And there are a lot of other state actors that are coming online that are dealing with this. But Ukraine is entering a political cycle right now. And do we see new characterizations, new hybrids, new mutations of this kind of tool being used in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, the positive outcome of the exposure of these influence operations, especially in the information space, has been hyper-awareness and sort of a laser focus on especially Ukraine, because there has been sort of a much more general acknowledgement that Ukraine has been the test case, as you say, the laboratory, the primary victim and target of Russian efforts. And so one thing that I've seen in Ukraine over the last few years is attacks on critical infrastructure systems, electrical grids especially.
Yeah.
There was the NotPetya attack was another instance of, I think, the kinds of future threats we're going to see where a virus, you can say, is unleashed that exploits a relatively minor exploit in a Microsoft system, but then reverberates and affects European businesses and reverberates back to Russia itself. So I think we're going to see more and more of these kinds of much more aggressive attacks that really touch on critical infrastructure systems. And I think in Ukraine, the elections, as you said, presidential elections just around the corner, they're coming up just in March. There are a lot of eyes on what's going to happen. I think there's going to be a space to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point highlighting the kinetic aspect. So back, I would say, before 2014, you know, we in the cyberspace were almost exclusively focused on the kinetic aspect and not the disinformation and hack and leak aspect of cybersecurity. And now we've kind of overcorrected, perhaps, and some of the things that we're seeing in Ukraine are examples of that. But, of course, the NotPetya attack, which was targeting Ukraine, the second hardest hit country was Germany, in fact. So it's definitely something that, you know, Germany is part of the backyard of Ukraine and all these countries. Getting back to the disinformation piece, you wrote an excellent report at Brookings in November entitled Weapons of the Week, Russia and AI-Driven Asymmetric Warfare. And you highlighted the return on investment of this kind of technology and this kind of tool. What are the incentives here for Russia to adopt, let's say, deepfakes? First of all, what are we talking about when we talk about deepfakes? What are the incentives here, and what can we expect to see in the near term?
I'm glad you asked the definition question. I think that's absolutely important to make sure we're all on the same page and talking about the same things. Of course, deepfake has become this term du jour, you could say, for kind of a catch-all concept for manipulation of audio and video content online. I do think it's important to highlight that deepfakes are AI-produced, AI-driven, incredibly advanced original content. What I mean by that is we think, well, you know, Photoshop has been around for a long time, so doctored images are nothing new,
right.
And doctored videos, we've
Stalin
seen as well.
Stalin was doctoring images in the 30s, right?
Exactly. But this is profoundly different. So the concept of the deepfake is different because our ability to detect manipulated video and audio has not caught up with the ability of these algorithms to produce these false audio and video. I'll give you one very quick example why it's so difficult, why it's not like Photoshop. So for example, anybody can Google this. If you Google Obama deep fake, this has become quite a famous video. You will see four videos of President Obama speaking. And I've showed these when I give talks on this, and I ask the audience to say, which one is the real Obama? And, you know, people pick one, and all of them are fake, of course. Mm. And what that signals to us is that because AI works off big data, and if you can feed a huge amount of data into this algorithm, what it can do is produce a new video. So it's not doctoring an existing video. It's actually producing a new video that looks right. So real and so convincing that we can't detect yet. The technology is not actually cut up yet to be able to detect this kind of false content. And to get back to the question, what does this mean, you know, for the next phase of disinformation or for the next phase of political warfare that countries like Russia may launch against the West, I think some of the implications are quite frightening, frankly. We could see, for example, an audio voicemail being left for troops serving in the Baltic states, or an email coming in saying this is from your commander, and it could be a video of the commanding officer sharing what is actually false or misleading information. And yes, you can people can verify that, but by the time the verification process happened, unless we have very clear processes in place for that verification, which we don't, as far as I know, that will already sort of serve the role of disorienting potential military operations, et cetera. And of course, in the online space, the implications are also quite profound. So, you know, now with the diffusion of information happening so quickly through Twitter, Facebook, all these social media networks of which we're all a part, you could see a video of a political leader going viral instantly. And by the time it's debunked, again, it's going to be too late. And what we know from research in this space is that fake videos or fake content that's much more sensationalist, that's much more fun to look at often because it's right. So sensationalist, spreads much faster than the accurate content that seeks to debunk that false, the false narrative or the false video and audio. So I think this is what we have to prepare ourselves for that is coming at us very, very quickly because the technology is easy to use, it's open source, and it's out there.
And we had an incident that was, it wasn't a deepfake, but it was a doctored video involving Jim Acosta, a CNN reporter at the White House, right. Where he supposedly shoved an intern who was holding a microphone, which had been doctored to show it that way. And before that could be verified independently as being a doctored image or a doctored video, you know, that had spread through channels like InfoWars and of course, some of the Russian channels that we could talk about, RT and Sputnik, et cetera. So,
well, just very quickly, and so I think the next step, just to kind of give people a visual of what this could look like, so there's a doctor video that's put up that's fake, but on top of that, what if we had, in your example, somebody like Acosta, then a video of him acknowledging that he did this? Right, that's the next step that I'm concerned about.
Right, and it could be a grainy video, you know, that is kind of a caught found footage kind of thing. You could think of a lot of gotcha videos similar to what's happened with Acorn and Project Veritas in the United States. One point that you emphasize in your piece, and I think it's a good one, is that Russia has been a technological leader in some areas, particularly in hard military assets, but in this area in particular, it has kind of lagged. So we have a situation where they will not be the developers probably of this technology, but more early adopters and probably early weaponizers. Who is developing this technology and what should the public policy process do to make sure that it's managed responsibly?
It's a fantastic and not an easy question. I mean, you bring up the Russia piece and you mentioned Russia earlier, you know, the return on investment that relatively, you say, weak states or can receive from investing in this asymmetric threat. You know, Russia is not a weak state in many ways. It has great military capacities, nuclear arsenal, of course. But if we look at its financial capabilities, its economy, demographics decline that it's struggling with. In general, Russia looks much more like a small economy the size of perhaps Spain or Italy. It doesn't look like a great power, like in terms of its economic capacity or in terms of its soft power capabilities either. And so from the Russian perspective, investing in these kinds of technologies, asymmetric threats, is a great way to balance out against those other inequities that the country experiences vis-a-vis Western Europe or vis-a-vis the United States. And so the question that you asked directly is, well, who are the innovators? Well, certainly it's a global market. I think if we look at a few different indicators, it becomes very clear who's going to be the innovator here. One, human capital. So obviously you need quite sophisticated, well-trained, highly skilled individuals in AI, machine learning, all these related fields. So that's number one. Number two, you need access to massive amounts of data because AI has been around for decades. Some of the first AI algorithms were written in the 1950s. And in fact, the algorithms that are being adapted today are not that different from what we saw in the 1950s. The big difference, of course, has been in our ability to process data, so data computation capabilities, and the mass availability of data that we're now collecting all the time. That has been the critical change. And so if we look at just those two factors, it's very obvious that China is going to be, if it's not yet already, leading in this area, because one, China is an authoritarian country, doesn't have to grapple with some of the concerns that we have in democracies about data privacy versus research or security. So the GDPR in Europe, for example, is one attempt to try to strike a balance between individual data privacy and the use of data by private companies. But as a side effect of that, it will affect AI research and its progress, because it's not really who controls AI that will control the world, as Putin once famously said, but it's who controls the data will control the world. And very clearly, China is already ahead in that space. And what we're seeing a lot of is not just Chinese students who study at the best universities in the United States or in Europe and then go back to China and deploy those skills there. We're also increasingly seeing American companies farming out or outsourcing their research, so not cheap labor anymore, but high-tech research, to places like China.
Right. And, a great example of this in the deep fake space is that, China has fabricated a synthetic newscaster, which is able to broadcast 24/7, modeled on one of their famous newscasters that they can broadcast whenever. But of course, another leader in this space, including China, of course, is the United States. And you have both the tech companies, but particularly in the deepfake space or the fake space, you have Hollywood, right? You have Pixar. Mm-hmm. Let's just say you have California, the two great centers of California, LA, and the Valley. If China is leading and the U.S. is also a leader in creating this technology, which is increasingly seen as dual use, how should governments regulate this? How should we protect democracies from this kind of technology being weaponized in civil society and open elections and so on?
Well, I think we're going to have to become much more innovative. Right now, I haven't seen any serious regulatory efforts, legislative efforts in the United States to really grapple with this problem, mainly because I don't see a clear technological solution. I don't want to get too much into the tech side of this,
right.
But what I mentioned about how deep fakes, which are driven by something called generative adversarial networks, which is actually two algorithms kind of talking to each other. The way the system works, exactly, or fighting each other. The way the system works is that it's able to very quickly then incorporate any algorithm that is designed to detect the manipulation that the system is producing, and then just gets reincorporated and fed back into the system again. So I think we're constantly going to be playing catch up with these kinds of tools. So on the regulatory side, it's very difficult to see where it goes from here, because on the one hand, In the United States, there's a general reticence among policymakers in the Democratic and Republican side around regulatory efforts for the big tech firms, Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. You could put Amazon, perhaps Netflix in there as well, who are driving so much of the economic growth in the United States. And there's also, of course, funding many congressional campaigns.
Right.
So there's a general reticence to regulate. I think there are some ideas being put on the table, not in terms of legislative proposals yet, that will be voted on, but just in terms of looking at antitrust legislation, perhaps, should at least break up these companies so they're not able to control as much information, not able to control as much of the data environment. There are conversations about implementing a parallel version of the GDPR, a U.S. version in the United States. But I think we have to start really from the very beginning here. But what I mean by that is, one, our policymakers need to know what they're talking about before they start legislating. And right now there is a serious gap between tech and policy, a lack of understanding that goes in both directions. So we have to understand the technology. And second, I think there is some precedent as to how to deal with big new industries like that, big new revolutionary changes. Of course, I'm talking about the digital revolution. Maybe forcing these companies have a common terms of use. This is something that the U.S. Congress has forced on credit card companies. It's also forced regulatory efforts on big tobacco back in the 1960s. So I think there is some precedent from other industries, but right now it remains, I think, very much an open field as to how regulatory efforts will be able to manage this next phase of technological development in our societies.
Yeah, and of course, as you said, Washington is dysfunctional and in all honesty is somewhat, let's say, charitably influenced by these sectors. Some could even say in some ways a bit captured by these sectors in the way that it shapes the regulatory environment, and for a long time left a lot of the policing to the industry itself. That's not necessarily the case in Europe, but it's more the case in the United States. But the United States itself is entering a political cycle again. There is obviously concern among people like you and me that Russia could try to deploy these kind of tools. Do you see this happening? We have a Democratic primary on our doorstep. What do you see happening? And how can the companies take more responsibility? Is there more pressure on the companies, particularly before these deepfake technologies are deployed?
Well, the pressure is certainly there. And Facebook and Twitter, and to a much, much lesser degree, I would say Google and its company YouTube, have been making some efforts to try to deal with this issue. Again, I think they've been relatively superficial, and I think these companies have not been particularly transparent. If I had to rank them in terms of how cooperative they've been with researchers, with governments, I actually think Twitter is most transparent and most open to sharing data, for example, on some of the networks that's identified as being malicious, suspicious, et cetera. The companies now called this kind of manipulated behavior inauthentic coordinated activity. And so we've heard a lot of, very high, publicized takedowns of networks on Facebook, of pages
right.
associated with Sputnik, for example. This just happened earlier this year. But we still don't have a very good sense of, is this really making a difference? I really think we're very much at the tip of the iceberg still. And what we have coming up, of course, the election season, unfortunately for those of us in D.C., has already started in Washington for 2020. We already have multiple Democratic candidates expressing their desire and their intent to run for the presidency. We've also heard stories and reporting that we're seeing some Russian disinformation efforts around very specific candidates. And so I think what that really tells us is, again, these disinformation campaigns have not stopped, and they won't stop because the platforms themselves are perfectly suited and perfectly designed to be the vectors of diffusion of these kinds of campaigns. Because it's the exact same tools that a private company like Nike wants to use to sell sneakers, the Russian government or the Chinese government, anyone else, can use to spread and amplify various narratives and disinformation. So this problem is not going away. It's ongoing. And the fact that it's ongoing signals that our efforts have been lacking.
You're completely right. And that's one of the things that we really need to bust when we talk about this, is the investment in AI. We talk a lot about AI in Europe. People talk about a Euro DARPA, all this money from the Defense Department, et cetera. But the truth is that the investment in this space, at least in the United States, comes primarily from ICT and is primarily driven towards advertising. It's just that boring. So we really need to focus on how that is occurring and how we can make sure that that keeps open resilient societies. One last question for you, Alina. You mentioned in your piece that what we need to think about is deterrence strategies. And, you know, you were talking about Russia, but how do you deter an authoritarian state where civil society doesn't really exist?
Well, I think that's actually where governments can be most effective. I think sending very clear messages as to the consequences for very specific actions, which is how traditional deterrence in the military space works. It's a bit more complicated in the cyberspace, you know, but sending the message via intelligence services channels from one side to the other, if we see an attack on our critical infrastructure, electrical grids, voting infrastructure, any sort of infrastructure like that, there's going to be a price to pay, and here's what's going to happen. And then following up on those kinds of threats. So I think that absolutely has to be a punitive component here. Others have suggested not so much a defensive strategy, which is basically what deterrence is, but a clear offensive strategy. I think there's a danger and a high risk there. So, for example, you mentioned there's not really a civil society space in places like Russia and China. In Russia, we still do see that. There are some independent media. I mean, they're basically censored and repressed by the regime. But there are some activists who are still there, who are still active in Russia on the ground. Some suggestions have been, you know, if we know that, for example, the Russians have planted certain malware on some of our electrical companies in the United States, which they have, maybe we should be doing the same thing to them. Or maybe we should explicitly and much more explicitly be supporting pro-democratic efforts in these countries in a way that at least the Russians are already convinced we are doing. I think this is all a debate that we're currently having, and all of these potential actions have certain risks associated with them. So far, what I've seen the U.S. government do is really lean on economic punitive consequences. Of course, right. I'm talking about sanctions. But again, it's not clear those are having the desired effect in changing Russian behavior that perhaps the administration was hoping for.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much, Alina. And I will give it back to David. David, wrap us up.
Yeah, well, I would like to thank the two of you. That was a very interesting and a very instructive conversation on AI-driven information. Alina, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on that and your perspectives. I certainly learned a lot, and I think I'm also talking on behalf of our participants today. Also, you know, what you told us about how AI-driven content is actually produced and how videos and audio material is manipulated. Very worrying indeed, and thank you so much also for, you know, your analyses and your perspectives on how government and politics can work. Thank you so much, Alina. And, of course, also thank you so much, Tyson. That was, you know, you grilled Alina.
Yes, but, she did.
you certainly asked the right questions and couldn't think of a better interview for that topic, and clearly showed that you know your part on cyber topics and the issue at stake. Again, thank you so much to the two of you and all our listeners for joining in today. And yeah, I hope you will join us again for the next Transatlantic call. And have a good evening or a good day in the US. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.